Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Rebecca Gordon, who is the author of a terrific new book called Mainstreaming Torture: Ethical Approaches to the Post-9/11 United States. Rebecca Gordon is a lecturer at the University of San Francisco. She is a longtime activist for women's rights, human rights, racial justice. She is the author of this terrific new book called Mainstreaming Torture. Rebecca Gordon, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you on. It is sadly still a very timely topic.
And
looks to be for much time to come. But let's see what we can do to change that. Your book is wonderful. I've read it. I recommend everyone do. You start out on what to some people will seem a startling fact, which is that there are polls showing that torture is more accepted now in the United States than it was when George W. Bush was president. How can that be?
That is a very interesting question, and it actually goes to the heart of the argument that I am making in this book, which is that torture, far from being something that happens in a moment of crisis, is actually an ongoing socially embedded practice, something that has its own infrastructure, its own institutions, traditions, initiations, rituals, all of those things, but which also affects the people who live in a country, especially a nominally democratic country in which torture is practiced. And I think what we've seen happening over the last, since September 11th, now almost 13 years, what we have seen happen is human beings in the U.S. have become habituated to being afraid. We are constantly reminded that we are in terrible danger. Every time you go to an airport, you go through the ritual of removing your shoes, you put your liquid objects into a little baggie that has to be exactly such and such a size. You are reminded that you are in danger and only a government which takes care of you can protect you. This same kind of security theater also appears in what a wonderful theologian, a guy named William Kavanaugh, has called a striptease of power. So we never have had a full disclosure by any means of everything that our government has done supposedly to protect us, but we've known enough to know that these are terrible things. And in the context of a government that we have been brought up to believe is essentially an actor for good in the world, the very fact that we believe that or have been taught to believe it makes us then recognize all the more how dangerous the world is if our government, a good government, is forced to do these terrible things. And I think that we have developed a habit of fear over the last 13 years that is far in excess of any actual danger that we're in.
Do you think part of that striptease of torture is a desire by some in the government to expose what they are doing, to use the fact that they are torturing people to generate fear and hatred and support for war and so forth? Or is it all against the will of everyone in government that the information has come out?
I think it's a little more complicated than that. I would say, for example, when Cy Hirsch and CBS revealed what had gone on at Abu Ghraib, and that news came out in 2004, I don't think that the Defense Department and the Bush-Cheney government were happy about it at first. But I don't think that they minded as much as their bluster in public suggested that they did. And I think that, and this question really goes to sort of the purpose of torture, because we are taught to believe that torture is a device, a method for eliciting information from people, information that otherwise they wouldn't give up. My argument, and the argument of other people, many other people who've studied it, is that that is certainly the pretext and the description that's given for torture in interrogation. But as experience in Latin America, in Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Chile, in Greece, in the Philippines, has shown over and over again, it's not really about getting information. Many times people will hold out and then finally give up a name or tell, something about an organization they work with, only to hear from the torturer, oh, we already knew. We just wanted to hear it from you. The point here is to destroy organizations that might be a threat or present some resistance to a political power by attacking the bodies of the people who make up those organizations. Now, clearly in the United States, for most people who have experienced torture in the war on terror, most of them have not been U.S. citizens, and the audience for that part of it has really been Iraqis and Afghans and people in other countries where the U.S. was fighting or is fighting an insurgency, and their torture had this, what I consider to be its usual purpose. In the United States, though, I think whether or not, and I don't have access to Dick Cheney's internal workings, I have no idea how the man's mind works, or President Obama's for that matter, but in this country, I do think that once the news begins to get out, it has very quickly been made use of by a government that wants to constantly remind us that we should be afraid. I don't really know whether they release information on purpose or not, but I will say that once it's released, it's absolutely taken up and used to demonstrate just how serious the problem is.
The question that always comes to my mind when I read about torture, and I, on the day that we're recording this, there was an article on a wonderful website that I usually love called Tom Dispatch that talked mm-hmm. about all of these types of torture, kidnapping and rendition, black sites, and all of it in the past tense, all of it as if it's completely over, all of it as if it happened up through the election of Barack Obama, and plenty of criticism for Barack Obama for not prosecuting, for going after whistleblowers is not a pro-Obama article, but just like thousands of other articles, as if there are no more secret prisons, as if no one's being rendered and tortured. Is torture over? Is torture to some extent over, or is it ongoing?
I wish that torture were over. And so let's break down some of the instances that you've talked about. So when President Obama came into power on the second or third day after his inauguration, he put out an executive order that supposedly closed the CIA black sites. Do you know if they've been closed? I don't know if they've been closed.
I know
some haven't. I don't know how I would know. But one of the things that it explicitly did not do was stop the practice that you've referred to of rendition. And what rendition means is taking a person that one country is holding and shipping that person off to another country where that person will very likely be tortured. And we have many, many testimonies from people from Guantanamo and other places who've been held by the U.S. and rendered. One of the most famous is a Canadian named Maher Arar, who was held for 10 and a half months in a Syrian prison at the behest of the United States. And this particular aspect of torture is actually forbidden under the UN Convention Against Torture, which the United States signed. So rendition's one thing, and we know that's still going on because the CIA explicitly said this is too valuable a technique or a tactic for us to give up. The other thing that, of course, hasn't happened is that Guantanamo hasn't been closed. And we know that people were being tortured in Guantanamo as recently as this past spring of 2013 because people were on hunger strike. And the people who were on hunger strike were twice a day being strapped into chairs for forcible nasal feeding. Now, that doesn't sound so bad, but the New York Times ran a story in the spring of a man describing to his lawyer what it was like. And he said, you know, first of all, the tubes are larger than the ones that are used in ordinary medical practice. And then without sedation or anesthesia, they shove the tube down your nose when you are strapped immobile into a chair. And then they begin pumping the food down through your esophagus into your stomach at a rate that is so painful that you feel, he said, it felt as though I had to vomit and I couldn't. He said it was the worst pain that he had ever experienced in his life. And, you know, he was going through this twice a day because he was on hunger strike because of other forms of torture that were still going on in Guantanamo, most especially solitary confinement. What's interesting is, because you talk about secret prisons, at the very same time of the most recent organized hunger strike in Guantanamo, there was an organized hunger strike of, at its height, up to 30,000 prisoners in California who were also striking and also being force-fed against the practice of putting people in solitary confinement for months and in years and in some cases decades. Decades without contact with another human being. We now know from work that's been done that within a couple of weeks, that kind of confinement can make a person hallucinate, become paranoid, hide gibbering in a corner. So I would say that, yes, it's still going on, and one of the main places it's still going on, in addition to the war on terror, is in our own prisons in this country. But because it's so ordinary, so much standard operating procedure, we don't even see it.
We are speaking with Rebecca Gordon, author of a terrific new book called Mainstreaming Torture. Rebecca, it seems to me that torture was going on, as you document in your book, by the federal government for decades prior to Bush and Cheney coming to town, and still is. But the conversation changed. It became more public. It became less outsourced to the point where we now have former presidents and vice presidents on book tours bragging mm-hmm. about it, swearing they'd do it again, defending it as noble and good. This seems decidedly different.
I completely agree with you. For many years, torture in the U.S. was covert. Now, if you wanted to know about it, you could. That is, you could know what happened at the School of the Americas. You could know that that's where over 60,000 members of the police and the armies and the National Guards of various dictatorships were trained in so-called interrogation methods using a manual that was developed in the 1950s and early 60s by the CIA. It's called the Kubark Manual. And this all sounds like inside baseball, detail-y stuff, but you can find it on the web. I mean, the Kubark Manual is available. In 1984, when I lived in the war zones in Nicaragua, I met people who, well, my work was traveling from village to village, interviewing people who had survived attacks by the counter-revolutionary force, the anti-Sandinista group called the Contras, that the U.S. was then illegally supporting and then later legally supported. And the people I met were people whose family members had been tortured to death in front of them. And it was a classic example of attacking civilians with terrifying methods on mutilations, tortures, in order to scare them. And I also met people who had been kidnapped by the Contra, taken into Honduras, tortured there with methods that may sound very familiar to you, things like ice-cold water and long exposure to the elements. Oftentimes, at least one man told me, with an American there who was watching who never said anything, except, you know, enough that the guy knew he was American. And then they, in turn, came back and did the same things to other people in Nicaragua. So the U.S. involvement was ongoing, but it was covert. It was hidden. It was supposed to be a secret. And most of it involved training after the war in Vietnam. Most of it involved training other people. What happened after September 11th, and it happened as early as the 5th of November, Newsweek ran a column by a guy named Jonathan Alter, who is very well-known historian and liberal columnist, in which he says, you know, in this winter of our anger, even a liberal like me finds his thoughts turning to torture. And this was sort of the beginning, the opening of a public conversation that I thought had, and many people thought had long ago been closed, that we had come to the conclusion that whatever our government did in private and we would work to try to stop it, the public consensus was that torture is just plain wrong. And sometimes when I was writing this book, I thought to myself, you know, I could sum this whole book up in 5 words. Torture is wrong. Stop it. But it became clear that that consensus was weak, and it began to come apart almost immediately. And so you began to see in mainstream media conversations about whether or not, under these circumstances, torture might not be necessary. The people that Alter was talking about torturing were among the about 600 Muslims living in the U.S., many of them U.S. citizens, who were Well, if it had happened to them in Latin America, we would have said they were disappeared. They were rounded up in the weeks right after September 11th. Most of them were kept in jail, and most people don't know about this, but it was in the New York Times, were kept in jail in Brooklyn, where they were exposed to things that will sound very familiar to people, incessant loud noise, incessant light and sleep deprivation, exposure to extremely cold temperatures while they were naked, and beatings. They were incommunicado. They literally, their families didn't know where they were. They were not given access to any kind of counsel, some for as long as 6 months. Some of them were held for a year. None of them, it turned out, had anything to do not only with September 11th, but with any form of terrorism. Some of them were in the U.S. on expired visas. Some of them had other minor bench warrants against them. None of them had anything to do with anything that threatened people in the United States. And yet these are the people that Alter, before he knew anything about them, was willing to say we need to either torture them, or if that's against our values, his second suggestion was that we should send them to Saudi Arabia, the land of beheadings, and let them take care of it. My point here is that very quickly, people came to believe that somehow only something as terrible as torture, whose ostensible purpose, what people were saying it was for, was to get information, was a sufficiently serious answer to the serious, dreadful attack that happened on September 11th, that nothing else would do somehow.
I think you hit an important point there. It's an attempt to be proportionate, not to be effective. And yet, as it develops, people across our society jump on board, and you have doctors taking part and psychologists developing torture programs, and academics, as well as columnists, moving. When I was a philosophy student, torture was the quintessential example of something evil, if you wanted to
talk about. Of what you wouldn't do.
Right. That's just an example anybody would pull out of something no one would ever do. Now, as you discuss at length and to great effect, in your book, there's a debate and there's an ethics discussion about the ethics of torture or of opposing torture. How are philosophers talking about this now?
Well, you know, I hesitated about even including that chapter in the book, but you know, it is an academic publisher, and the reason I even talk about the ethicists, the philosophers, is that they're very arguments are the same ones that you also see in the mainstream press. They're just dressed up in fancy, you know, ethical, philosophical language. But basically, what most of them do is they make what I think is a mistake, which is they act as if torture was something you would do in the moment because you have a crisis on your hand. And so for utilitarians, which is the way most of us most of the time think about the ethical decisions we make. It means you stop and think, if you have time, what's going to bring about the greatest good for the largest number of people? And so you have a problem, you're Jack Bauer, and you have a terrorist in front of you, and he knows where the bomb is that's going to blow up Los Angeles. You have 2 hours to get the information out of him. Do you torture him? This is a problem that is so common that it has its own name. It's called the ticking time bomb problem. And a lot of people have debunked it. And in fact, this is the one case in which somebody is most likely to hold that because he knows what the time limit is. So even if the person has the information, which oftentimes you don't know that you actually do. But this is the argument that the utilitarians make. The deontologists. So deontology is this other way of doing ethics that says that...
In fairness to utilitarians, myself being a professed one,
isn't this
the argument that bad utilitarians make who ignore all of the horrible side effects that you're going to tell us about in a minute?
I don't know if it's fair to say they're bad, because they're certainly serious. But what I would say is that there's also a utilitarian argument against torture.
Indeed.
Which is, and it's not genuinely utilitarian, it's instrumental. It says basically, if we torture people we capture on the battlefield, then if our soldiers are captured, they'll get tortured too. And so it's about the consequences. It's not about whether it's wrong, whether there's something in the action itself that's wrong, but it's more about what the consequences would be for the people we care about more than we care about the people we've captured. Real utilitarianism says there's no distinction in between the personhood of your enemy soldier and the personhood of your own soldier. But we have this tendency to sort of put together in this as if it were everybody and say the greatest number is really the greatest number of Americans. And there's a real tendency to make that slip.
Right. So you have the simple-minded dumb utilitarian, then you have the xenophobic nationalist utilitarian. But
exactly.
If you had an informed, intelligent utilitarian who looked at the fact that it won't actually work, that you have to develop a whole program that's going to have all sorts of evil side effects, that is going to be abused inevitably. And so, you know, that's looking at consequences. It's just looking at all the consequences. Right.
Exactly. And I think it's a good argument. The only thing I think that argument, and I don't disagree with that argument, because I think that it's true. And one of the consequences is that because you can't just torture without practice, you have to keep practicing, and you have to build an infrastructure, and it also has a demoralizing effect on the people who do it. I'm also interested in the demoralizing effect that it has on the society that knows it's being done.
Yes,
and
indeed.
And so that's why I think you also need to go a little bit further and look at what are some of the moral habits that we form when we allow people to be tortured for our own protection. Does that make sense?
Exactly, yes.
So, I mean, I had a working title for this book, which was A Nation of Cowards. And the publisher quite reasonably thought that that might be a little too strong. But my concern is that, in fact, by saying whatever it takes to guarantee my personal safety must be done, that to me is the definition of cowardice. And I believe with my guy Aristotle that when we act in a cowardly way, we in fact develop a habit of cowardice. And I think that in fact, you know, modern neurology does, you know, what they're learning about how we work and how the brain changes. Our repeated thoughts and our repeated actions do actually affect the structure of who we are. Not only, not only in our memories, but also literally physically in our flesh, in our brains.
I think it's
not a good thing.
It's a very important point, and one that I don't look at enough, because I'm always looking at the point that I think is simultaneously true, that it doesn't work, that it makes us less safe, that it's a recruiting tool for more terrorism and so forth.
Right.
I think that
can
be...
And that's an important point, too. But I'm concerned about what it then makes us, for example, say we want to shift our concern for a moment from torture to assassination by drone. If we are a society which has become acclimated to the idea that somebody must be tortured to keep me safe, how much easier is it for me to say, oh, well, and terrorists, without any kind of legal action at all, without ever being brought to trial, without any kind of defense, may be executed half a world away, whether they are U.S. citizens or not, simply because they have been designated as terrorists. It becomes easier to accept that if we have become accustomed to accepting whatever needs to be done to keep us safe. In a way, it's basically a denial of mortality. It's this quixotic belief that if the government can just protect us enough, we will never die. And if somebody else has to suffer or die, well, that's the price. But we're not paying it.
And the polls that you begin with suggest that that people are increasingly accepting of the torture argument, but are significantly more accepting of the murder argument.
Right.
That is, president
they're,
can
they're
go...
They're even more willing to murder people than torture them, which is interesting, isn't it, in a rather frightening way.
I think it's a selfish, xenophobic problem.
We don't have a consensus that killing people is wrong. We used to have a consensus that torturing them was wrong.
That's right. And it's harder for the torturer to torture, and for the nation that tortures to live with itself as a nation that tortures. But for a nation to know that the president is going through a list of men, women, and children on Tuesdays and picking which ones to murder, and somebody somewhere is pushing a button, and it's done very cleanly, and we don't have to see any videos of the suffering and the screaming, it's somehow easier, even though most people would rather be tortured than murdered.
Or think they would. they don't actually know. And it's interesting, when I lived in and worked in Nicaragua, the North Americans I was with, I'm with you. I'm opposed to mortality. I don't like the idea of dying. My great fear was not being tortured, it was being killed. Most of the North Americans I worked with, their fear was torture. They weren't afraid of dying nearly as much as they were of being tortured. So I think that we probably can't make generalizations about that. But I also think we don't have to separate them, because I think they are a seamless garment. They are part of the whole process of war and of the kind of power regime that it takes to keep, you know, capital in power. And I think that they are different, but I don't think they're unconnected. The one thing I want to bring us back to, though, is this question of torture in U.S. prisons. I mean, it's no accident that the folks at Abu Ghraib, the lower down folks who were reservists, were many of them corrections officers in their ordinary civilian life. And the things that they did in Abu Ghraib were not unfamiliar to them because they had done them before. And there's a famous quote from Corporal Grainer who was one of the ringleaders. He says, "The Christian in me knows it's wrong, but the corrections officer in me loves to see a grown man piss himself." And, you know, one of the ways we've become inured to torture is by watching police procedurals, you know, Law and Order, SVU. Are we going to rough up the perp? Are we going to threaten the perp with being raped if he goes to jail? As if rape were an ordinary part of a sentence, right?
Yeah.
We've come to accept it as so normal, we don't even question it. Or when I say we, I mean many of us. Not all of us. And that's my final point. We can stop this.
We have about a minute left, so that's great timing. let me just ask one final question, which is, if we have this problem of torture and we have this new problem of assassination and we have the ongoing problems of kidnapping and rendition and lawless imprisonment, all of this seems to come out of the idea of war. At some point, as ethical beings, don't we have to take on the institution and the military funding that is generating this whole range of atrocities?
Absolutely. And, I mean, you know that you and I don't disagree about this. The only thing I would say is, even if the U.S. did not have the industrial military complex that it does, we would still be in the position of imprisoning the largest absolute number of human beings in the world in our prisons, and most of those are people of color. So we would still have a problem of torture, and if you include capital punishment, murder, even without war. But obviously war does it on a much greater scale. And yes, that is the problem we have to confront, and we have to confront the economic benefits that some people derive from war. No question about it.
Very well said. The book is Mainstreaming Torture. The author is Rebecca Gordon. Rebecca, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.